From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. For over 25 years, Amnesty International has confronted governments throughout the world to stop the torture of prisoners and release prisoners of conscience. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Amnesty's U.S. Executive Director, Jack Healey, about those ongoing battles and about his recent attempts to raise consciousness through international rock tours. Also today, I speak with novelist Trey Ellis. His first novel, Platitudes, parodies the conventions of contemporary black literature and experimental fiction. Ken Tucker reviews the latest albums by the reunited versions of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and Little Feat. And Stephen Schiff looks at women on the verge of a nervous breakdown, the latest film by the Spanish director Pedro Almodovar. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. December 10th is Human Rights Day. This Saturday also marks the 40th anniversary of the day the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Amnesty International is a human rights group whose work is based on the principles of the Declaration. Amnesty works to stop the torture and execution of all prisoners and campaigns to release prisoners of conscience. It also monitors human rights violations around the world. My guest Jack Healey has served as the executive director of the U.S. branch of Amnesty since 1981. Healey initiated a series of benefit rock concerts to raise consciousness about human rights violations. This fall, he led an international concert tour that featured Bruce Springsteen, Sting, Peter Gabriel, and Tracy Chapman, and made stops in the U.S., Canada, Tokyo, Zimbabwe, the Ivory Coast, Brazil, and Argentina. Under Healy's leadership, the American branch has grown from 40,000 to 300,000 members. I spoke with Healy about his efforts to use show business on behalf of human rights, but I asked him first to describe the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the document whose anniversary will be celebrated this weekend.
40 years ago, you know, after what the Nazis did to Europe, the world got together and drew up a document to try and prohibit that ever repeating itself. And in it, in the Declaration of Human Rights, is set a vision on how governments really ought to be treating their people. And given 40 years later, one-third of the governments are torturing every day with systemic state machinery. And half the governments in the UN have political prisoners in them. We haven't gotten very far. And so what we wanted to do was highlight this, the 40th anniversary, and restore a sense of hope to it.
How does Amnesty International use the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
Well, we took from the Declaration of Human Rights four main points: the political imprisonment, torture, and executions, and a fair trial if you're picked up by government. We stick to those, but we took them from the Declaration, and the Declaration is a much broader document. But we thought in its 40th anniversary that, given that Amnesty is an international body and the UN and all that, we thought we'd celebrate the 40th anniversary in a way that would put a constituency behind the document.
Amnesty International works, among other things, to free prisoners of conscience. Now, how do you define a prisoner of conscience?
Prisoner of conscience is someone who's never used or advocated violence and is in jail for their race, color, creed, or ethnicity. They're normal, average, decent people who just shouldn't be in jail. They never did anything. They just shouldn't be there.
Because of that clause that says a prisoner of conscience is someone who hasn't used or advocated violence, are there any people whose efforts you'd like to support but you can't because they were revolutionaries and did use or advocate violence?
Well, certainly Nelson Mandela would be one, but he's used in that, you know, he's advocated violence in the struggle against apartheid. But we adopt his wife, Winnie, who has never used or advocated violence. When she goes to jail, she becomes a prisoner of conscience. And that's the difference. It's one who uses and one that doesn't use violence.
One of the techniques that Amnesty uses is to try to shame governments into stopping torture or releasing prisoners of conscience. And it always shocks me that a government that can sanction torture can somehow be shamed by the public knowledge of it.
A government is a lot like a personality. It seeks endorsement and wants to avoid criticism. And so what we do is whack them as hard as we can when they have human rights abuse. And they feel it, and at times they respond, times they don't, of course.
You use a lot of letter writing. You encourage the members of Amnesty International to send letters to who the prisons where the prisoners of conscience are held. To whom are the letters addressed?
Well, to sometimes the prison official, the presidents, minister of justice, the prison themselves, the family of the prisoners. We use any clever, nonviolent means we can to get someone out of jail.
What does a typical letter say?
It respects the government and asks for the release of that prisoner. We know where they are, what prison they're in, and that they haven't done anything wrong. And we ask the government to let them out.
If a government or a prison gets, say, hundreds of letters on behalf of a prisoner of conscience, how does that affect them? I guess if they know that it's an organized campaign, a campaign organized by Amnesty International, does that make it more powerful or less powerful?
I think the technique,
yeah.
From the prisoners that we have been released, prisoners of conscience, seems like it's powerful. The evidence is that like one prisoner in the Republic of South Africa said on the first 50 letters, I got into a better cell. The next 50 letters came, I got some clothes. The next 50 letters, I got some food. And eventually, I became a leader in the prison due to the letters that were coming in. What it also does is alert the torturer and the executioner that we know that they're there doing their dirty business. And that public light stops them at times.
How do you know? How do you find out who is in jail and who is being tortured, since that is frequently kept a secret even from the family of the people who are imprisoned?
We have about 250 people in London, our international secretariat, that monitor the world on a daily basis, a minute-by-minute basis. And their job is to monitor the world, get the information out to the world, into us sections around the world. The U.S. is one of 44 sections around the world.
What is the history of the letter-writing technique? How was that technique first developed?
It was our founder, Benenson, who was angry when he heard about two Portuguese kids who got 6 years in jail for toasting to freedom in a bar in Portugal. He wrote a letter that got published in Le Monde, and the response was so incredible that it essentially began Amnesty International. So we were letter writing from Jump Street, really.
My guest is Jack Healy, and he's the executive director of Amnesty International in the USA. You've developed a new kind of consciousness raising for Amnesty International, and that is the Rock benefit. In 1986, you did a 6-city tour of the United States of rock concerts for consciousness raising, and you followed that up this past fall with a series of concerts that took you to several continents. Bruce Springsteen and Sting, Peter Gabriel were some of the performers who participated. What gave you the idea of doing these rock concerts for consciousness raising?
Oh, I had it, golly, 1971, I tried to do a tour of the United States with the Raspberries from Cleveland. I always wanted to do it, really. And I never could really get it done. I tried it with Dick Gregory's World Hunger Run in 1976 with Stevie Wonder. It didn't work out. And I just kept coming. When I come back from Africa as a Peace Corps director to become director of Amnesty, I went to Bill Graham right away and said, Bill, I'd like to try this. I think there's a take here. And then eventually he said, well, you get the talent, I'll do it. And eventually I talked to you too, and they joined us, and that's how we started the Conspiracy of Hope. The second one really is like an effort to celebrate the Declaration. I thought the only way to celebrate the Declaration of Human Rights is to do it truly around the world, and that's how that tour came to be.
Mm-hmm. Did you learn any lessons from Live Aid, which was also a really big rock consciousness-raising event, about what worked and what didn't?
Oh, yeah, to keep your message clear and pure and tough, and not to give in to any censorship or to really, like, make your message eminently clear and acceptable in the sense of making it totally clear that you can accept or reject the message and not to fuzz it in any way.
One of the criticisms that was leveled at Live Aid is that it risked in the television broadcast becoming a self-righteous commercial for the corporate sponsors of the concert. What kind of considerations did you have about what kind of corporate sponsor you'd want to use for your event so that you had financial backing, but it didn't become just a commercial for the sponsor?
Well, we went to great lengths with the Reebok Corporation to do an underwriting, not a sponsorship. We wouldn't have it at the back of the stage. We wouldn't guarantee anybody where clothes or shoes. We took out all of that. And they did a gentle underwriting, I call it. And it really was like their lawyer told us this is the worst contract he's ever seen because it guaranteed them nothing. And that's exactly what we wanted, except an association. We did not want a corporate overlay to, you know, human rights or to Amnesty or to... And so we set up a Concerts for Human Rights, which is different IRS number from Amnesty, and that's how we did it, to keep that independence and freedom which we need in the human rights movement.
Did you check out the potential corporate underwriters for their political background and to see what their operations were like, so that you wouldn't be doing business with someone who was in their own way cooperating with the kind of repression that you were working against?
Yeah, in fact, we got certified letters from good groups, like the Corporate for Corporate Responsibility. We got a letter certified from them saying they didn't have any South African holdings. And we looked at their contracts in South Korea and Taiwan. Yeah, we went to great lengths, and we checked with a lot of people and got certified letters from them that they were clean.
When you started doing these rock concerts, were you listening at the time to a lot of rock music, and were you up to date on who all the really popular bands were?
No, I'd never heard of U2. I'd heard of Jackson Brown, I guess, but no, I really am not a rocker. I like music, but I'm not really a rocker, no.
So what did you do for a crash course so that you'd know who to approach?
I crashed. when you deal with Bill Graham and managers, you do crash. it's a hard world to work in. I do my best. I don't always do the right things, but we got the job done twice, Conspiracy Hope and the Human Rights Now tour. And it's rough. It's hard work. There's a lot of conflicting interest, and it's hard to bring it all together.
Well, there must have been times when you met some superstar rock performer whose work you weren't really familiar with, and they, on the other hand, probably also didn't know much about Amnesty International until you really talked to each other for a while. Did that happen?
Yeah, a whole lot. But, you know, the British groups and the Irish groups know about Amnesty, and they really, you know, Sting and Peter Gabriel have been with Amnesty as long as I have been, mm-hmm. as a donor or as an activist. But U2 is already members of the Irish section. So some of them, yeah, but it was more Americans. They really had to have their consciousness raised. They really don't know about human rights, and so it took some time. Jackson Brown, though, and Joan Baez, of course, been with us for years and years and years, mm-hmm. and so it was nice to have them.
Rock stars are notorious for being spoiled and catered to. When they travel in luxury. Backstage, they expect champagne and specially prepared foods, and they make all kinds of demands on the promoters and on the people who are holding the concert. Did you talk to the bands beforehand and tell them to keep that kind of stuff at a minimum during the tour for human rights?
Yeah, I told them we were going to be Spartan. That was it, and there was no argument about that, and they agreed to that readily, though. I mean, the bands we had with us are just incredibly good people, and it doesn't take much convincing either. I mean, the managers are very much with us on that type of thing. In fact, they're tougher on finances than we would be, because, you know, we don't know rock and roll and how much a stadium costs. They're very helpful to all that. And they want as much to come to Amnesty as possible.
Were there countries that you wanted to take the concert to but had a hard time getting into?
Well, first, we never thought we'd get into the Eastern Bloc. We wanted to. We never thought we would. We got into Hungary and really mm-hmm. wonderful. We're pleased about that. We wanted to play in the Soviet Union. We never got there. We'd like to try China, too, but we didn't get there either. We'd like to play in those two large population bases because they, too, are signatures to the Declaration of Human Rights.
Mm-hmm. Now, this must have been a new experience for you because you, I think, at most of the concerts addressed the crowd before the concert began. Is that right?
Did I address them?
Yeah.
A number of them, yeah.
Yeah.
I did, sure.
Well, it's a really big crowd to talk to.
Yeah, about 90,000 most of them.
It's hard to keep the attention of 90,000 people. And I have to say, I think especially so at a rock concert where people are notoriously impatient until their favorite singer comes on. I mean, they're even rude to, very rude sometimes to opening acts. Did you ever have to quiet an impatient crowd in order to get them to listen to you?
We never really had that problem. I mean, we played in a hurricane in Costa Rica, and the kids were standing in 6 inches of mud. They didn't move. No, we never had that problem. We had the opposite problem of so many people trying to get into the stadium. No, we had never had that problem.
But I meant like while you were talking, of people in the audience talking.
Well, I mean, they carry on as normal concert goers, but I think they have an extra devotion to human rights. I mean, you know, I think there is a bit of concert fatigue in UK and the United States. There is not concert fatigue in Costa Rica, Zimbabwe, Ivory Coast, India.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
they're anxious to see you and they love you. And, you know, you take disappearances, for instance. It doesn't mean much. That word doesn't mean much to Americans. But to Latin Americans, It means incredible pain level. Everybody knows someone has been killed, tortured. It means something when you go down there and sing about disappearances when Sting sings They Dance Alone. They emotionally get caught up in it. They're with us. It's like one big happy celebration, everybody crying and weeping because they know what disappearances mean.
What do you think the gains were finally for Amnesty International by taking these concert tours around the world?
Well, we hope all around the world there'll be a backdrop where there might become more domestic human rights groups, monitoring groups, authentic groups. We hope we have more members in Amnesty, especially in the third world. We want to grow there. And I think in the West what we needed, it's not seen as like we're seen as popular and all that, but we really do need growth in the United States as well as Spain, Italy, UK. You know, one-third of the governments are torturing every day. How are we going to stop them? We got to get stronger.
Was this controversial at all within Amnesty International? Did you get any criticisms from within your group for mixing show business and human rights?
Amnesty is a wonderful democracy, so everything is controversial. And we love democracy, and we love dissent, you know? I mean, we're usually for the people carrying signs, even if it's against us. No, sure, we had a lot. And, you know, a lot of people said this is frivolous. But we think the results will prove we'll be okay. And certainly the dissidents of thought, I have it too. You know, I worry about the results as well. We all have that, and we're glad to have the dissidents and argue and back and forth. But overall, I think our first experience with the Conspiracy Hope was it was good. We were a post-40 organization until the Conspiracy Hope. We now have young people with us. We have 1,000 high schools with us, for instance. Those young kids work like dogs. I mean, they produce 5,000-10,000 signatures on a petition. It's great. And when they come to our meetings, they're part of our movement. It's really terrific.
You said there are, however, some things that you do worry about this mix of show business and human rights. When you do worry, what are the things that you think about?
Any corporate underwriting. I wish I could have done it without them.
Mm-hmm.
But given that we did it, Reebok was good and it worked. I worry about that rock and roll is seen as frivolous and stupid and there's no connection between the two, that the people come to the concert just come to hear music and the other side of it, they don't turn into human rights activists. If they don't, then the concert hasn't worked. I think we worry about bringing Western values to the third world and being seen that way. But it didn't work that way because mm-hmm. they really welcomed us in it. So mm-hmm. we were pleased about it. But we were deeply worried about that. We worried we couldn't play an Eastern Bloc. It would be seen as a Western celebration,
uh-huh.
not a universal declaration. And we worried about ethnicity on the stage. So we had a local band, national local band, everywhere we went. You worry about all types of things like that, getting through borders. Can you play where people really don't like you? And we were able to.
Let me ask you about one other worry. Do you ever worry about why we need celebrities to get people to think about certain issues?
Well, I'll tell you, when the nonviolent are in the struggle with the violent, I on the nonviolent side will use any means
mm-hmm.
I can.
Mm-hmm.
And if that takes, you know, all types of foolishness and silliness, I'll do it if, in fact, the result is that the nonviolent can stop the violent, especially these governments who are killing and torturing people every day with no accounting to anybody. They need to be faced off. They need to be someone in their face. They need someone pressuring them, they embarrassing them. I want to chase them. I just want to chase them.
Do you think you'll do this again, this kind of concert tour?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
I don't want to become a rock and roller. I'm not a promoter. I'm a human rights activist, and whatever will move our movement in the direction of stopping governments from killing and torturing people, I'll do it. But it's not planned that I don't want to get into that mode.
Okay. Well, I want to talk with you more about your human rights work, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Jack Healy, the executive director of Amnesty International USA. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Jack Healy is the executive director of Amnesty International USA. Amnesty seeks the release of prisoners of conscience and fair and prompt trials for all political prisoners. The group opposes torture and executions. Amnesty tries to uphold the rights proclaimed by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is adopted by the UN General Assembly 40 years ago this Saturday. Jack Healy, I'm interested a little bit in your life and how you came to work for human rights. I know in the late 60s you were a Catholic priest, and I was wondering why you first entered the seminary.
Oh, I sort of was a mischievous kid, and, you know, a young priest came to me and said, I'm better than that, and I should do something better with my life. And he talked me into it, and I went and tried it, and I liked it. Franciscan tradition is a good tradition. It's a peaceful tradition. It's one that respects the nature, life, and it was a good one. And I'm glad I grew up that way.
What kind of work were you doing as a priest?
I did civil rights work, anti-war work, homeless, soup lines. I'm a devotee of Dorothy Day. Jim Grappi of Milwaukee was a good friend of mine. Those kinds of people, Fannie Lou Hamer.
Mm-hmm.
I love them.
Why did you decide to re-enter the secular world?
I essentially, that world was too small for me. You know, we were going to bed at 9 o'clock at night. And the world was too small. That was too small for me. I just had too bored. I had to get going. I had to see the world, do something in the world. And it didn't offer me that opportunity eventually.
Did you stay committed to the faith after leaving the priesthood?
Yeah, reasonably. I would say reasonable. I wouldn't go claiming I'm great at it. But I'm deeply devoted to religious belief, though. Belief in God, yeah.
Did you go a little bit wild after you left?
No, I didn't know how to. I've been a Franciscan so long. It takes a while to get those shackles off. But I guess some people would accuse me of that. But I have a lot of energy, and I've always had it, luckily. And I guess a lot of people would see I went wild, but I don't think so. No.
Now, I think the place where you were first introduced to Amnesty International was in Lesotho, in Africa, where you were director of the Peace Corps in Lesotho. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I'd been a donor for years, small donor, you know, $10, $15. I don't have much money, but I gave when I could. And then I was in Lesotho, and that's when human rights came to me. They were killing essentially the Protestants. The Catholic government was killing Protestants, and it was really upsetting. I went to the prisons, and I knew the prisoners coming out of South Africa. I got to know them well. Got to know the ANCs, the PAC. I got to know everything about Southern Africa as a layman could. And I just decided I got to do something about all these things. I don't know what. And then I got a mailing from Amnesty, which I'd been trying to get one for years. I never got one. Somehow this one reached me. And then had an ad for executive director. I answered it.
And that's how you got the job?
Yeah, I didn't know anybody or anything.
You know, it seems to me in your position as the director of Amnesty International that you're really exposed to the best and the worst of human nature. You see people sacrificing their lives for social justice. On the other hand, you see people torturing these people. So you're really exposed to the best and the worst. And I was wondering if there was a war going inside you between optimism and pessimism about the human spirit.
Yeah, sure. You go through that all the time. You also go through... You know, a victim of torture tells you again how they've been tortured. It's horrendous. I mean, you really... But on the other hand, you got to get your inspiration from somewhere. And the victims of torture, families of the disappeared, of the executed, are my inspiration, without question. They give me drive and vigor, and most of my support comes from there. I'm a bit crazy. They like that. I mean, they want someone, you know, hell-bent on getting something done, and that's what I try to do.
Can you tell the story of one of your successes that continues to inspire you and to help you believe that there are results to the work?
Yeah, it's people who survive torture, and you know they go through their whole life, and it comes back to them like a demon in the night, and they got to deal with it practically daily or every other day. And I know them, and I watch their struggle to keep their sanity, not to kill themselves, not to. You know, to live in spite of the damage that's been done to them. And the power that they bring to their life just to survive and be a normal human being is very inspiring to me. And I know a lot of them, and I love them for it. And it does a lot for me. It makes my life seem insignificant and my problems insignificant because I don't have that kind of thing to deal with.
It's important, I guess, to meet the individuals who have been freed so that your work at Amnesty doesn't become thinking about a lot of statistics, but rather about actual people.
I think that's how our whole movement feels. It deals with a single prisoner. It sets up a relationship with a single prisoner. And that's the glory of amnesty, really, and the power of it. We deal between one average, normal, decent person and the imprisoned average, normal, decent person. That relationship makes it go.
Amnesty International makes a point that it's a humanitarian group and not a political group.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder where and why you draw that line.
Because we got to be credible with governments to influence them. And so we have to be pragmatic. And what we want to do is free prisoners, stop torture and executions, give fair trials for people. That's our goal. So we're pragmatic about that. And in order to do that, you got to do that with balance and partiality. The day you joined a lefty or a righty, you'd be gone. The left would never deal with you again. The right would, you know, eventually would see that you're just unprincipled, and they'd drop you too. What you need is someone out there who just doesn't want the endorsement of either one and just does their work and sticks to the human rights abuses of government, doesn't attack the government, but attacks the human rights abuses. That's what we try to do.
Would it be asking you to step outside of your role to comment on Gorbachev's comments?
Any progress in human rights is terrific. And if he fulfills his promises, that's terrific. That's encouraging the human rights movement. And if the two superpowers of the world lead in morality and decency, it certainly would improve this world of ours. In fact, he and Reagan or Bush could remove torture the way they remove missiles. It's doable, just like that.
Is there a particular case of special interest to you now, a particular political prisoner or prisoner of conscience?
Yeah, sure. We always have them, and we always work, with them. We had one, Maskey, on the tour that Sting talked about, and he got out right after the tour. I think overall, in campaigns, what we try to do is take any group of people, any community, the government is trying to turn into lesser people and give them a name so they can torture and kill them. We rally to them. We watch that no one becomes a lesser person in this world. And so one day it could be the Kurds, next day the Palestinians, the next day the Green Irish, the next day the Orange, the Sunni in a Shiite country, a Shiite in a Sunni country, Malay in a Chinese. You have to watch the underdog, the minority, the people they're trying to make less, and you protect them. By protecting everybody, you protect all of us. When you fail anybody, you fail the whole thing.
Can you pass on the comments that anybody has made to you after getting released from jail, in part because of a letter-writing campaign? Have you had that opportunity to hear people directly address that?
Yeah, it humbles you. It really humbles you. Simon Farisani, South African minister, Lutheran minister from Venda, in the north of Republic of South Africa, says he's alive because of amnesty. Veronica De Negri says she's alive because of the hope we gave her after she was tortured in Chile, and then when her son was torched by the Chilean police, she felt solidarity with Amnesty and other human rights groups and make her feel alive. Juan Mendez of the America's Watch is a victim of torture. He says he's alive because of the hope he gets off people, like the human rights people in Amnesty. There's really hundreds of thousands of them. The Soviets, prisoners who've come out historically over the years, felt that even though sometimes we didn't get them out of the gulag, if they were reached by a letter and someone remembered they were alive, that they weren't forgotten, that someone knew they had a wife and a kid, that this restored hope to the prison and they could last longer. These are all humbling things.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us about your work in human rights. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Jack Healy. He's the executive director of Amnesty International USA. And this Saturday is Human Rights Day. It marks the 40th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was adopted by the UN General Assembly on December 10th, 1948. And by the way, this Saturday evening, HBO will present a documentary of Amnesty's Human Rights Now concert tour. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with educator and child psychiatrist James P. Comer. His new book, Maggie's American Dream, is about his mother and her journey from childhood poverty in Mississippi to East Chicago, where she put four children through college and helped them all become successful professionals. Comer says his mother's extraordinary efforts against great obstacles is an example of why people speak with such pride about the Black family. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Trey Ellis says black novelists are expected to write about cotton fields or rats. His first novel, Platitudes, defies those expectations. It's an elaborate parody of the macho black novel and the black feminist novel. Coming up, Trey Ellis reads from and discusses his new book. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new albums by two old groups, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and Little Feat. And the Spanish director Pedro Almodovar has a new film, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. A DC-7 under contract to the U.S. Agency for International Development was apparently attacked and downed in the Western Sahara today. All five crew members on board were presumed killed. A second DC-7 accompanying the first was said to have been damaged but was able to land. The planes were involved in locust spraying efforts in Senegal and were flying to Morocco when attacked. A White House statement said the government of Morocco was cooperating fully in investigating the incident. In Honduras today, a U.S. Army helicopter crashed, killing at least three American servicemen. The helicopters was taking part in a routine mission when the apparent accident occurred. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev left New York this afternoon, one day early, as the severity of yesterday's earthquake in the southern Soviet Union became clear. Tens of thousands are believed to have died. Official Soviet media said the earthquake wiped out villages and destroyed half of the city of Kirovakan, a city of 170,000 people. Relief supplies and doctors were sent to the area in the southern part of the Soviet Union. The quake measured a 6.9 on the Richter scale. Gorbachev, who was planning on opening a Soviet trade exhibit and doing some sightseeing in New York today, left New York's Kennedy Airport for Armenia early this afternoon, canceling planned stops in Cuba and London. Before he left, Gorbachev said he heard this morning from the White House.
I had telephone conversations with President Reagan and Vice President Bush. Both of them expressed profound condolences on behalf of the American people to those affected and to the government and people of the Soviet Union.
As NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports, the president's phone call came on a busy day for Mr. Reagan, who also spent time preparing for a news conference he scheduled for later tonight.
The Reagans made the call from the family quarters of the White House this morning to the Gorbachevs at the Soviet mission in New York. They expressed their concern to Mr. and Mrs. Gorbachev and offered assistance. President-elect Bush also phoned the Soviet leader and told him the American people will want to hold out their hands to those families who lost loved ones. In a ceremony this afternoon, Mr. Reagan signed a proclamation for Human Rights Week. He said in a statement he was not yet satisfied, but real progress had been made.
Much remains to be done to translate words into deeds, to bring the peoples of the Soviet Union the full rights to which their government has committed itself under international agreements.
At tonight's news conference, President Reagan is likely to face questions about how his views on the Soviet Union have changed. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Supporters of African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela today demanded his unconditional release. The South African government has been under intense domestic and international pressure to release the 70-year-old activist, who has been in prison since 1962. Yesterday, Mandela was transferred from a prison clinic to a house on a prison farm. Archbishop Desmond Tutu accused the government of playing games, pointing out that Mandela is still a prisoner. Anti-apartheid leaders Desmond Tutu and Alan Bosek met with two U.S. senators in Cape Town, South Africa today. The two political activists told Senator Sam Nunn and David Boren that they hope the U.S. takes the lead in fighting racial segregation in South Africa. Bosak said the 40-minute meeting with the two senior Democrats had been very good. Bosak and Tutu support international sanctions to force an end to apartheid. They have condemned President Reagan for opposing tougher U.S. sanctions. House Armed Services Committee Chairman Les Aspin said today that President-elect Bush is making his first serious misstep by failing to end speculation over whether he will name Senator John Tower as defense secretary. There have been reports that Bush and his advisors want to name as many as five top Pentagon officials at one time, including Tower. Aspin said if Tower is named now, he'll take office in a weakened condition. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Two rock groups that were popular in the 70s are together again, recording and performing, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and Little Feat. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of their new albums. This is the current sound of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
Men who were fighting for all of our lives are now fighting for children, for homes and for wives, fighting for the memory of all who fell. But the soldiers of peace just can't kill anymore.
Rock and roll reunions are generally bad news insofar as they attempt to stir up an empty nostalgia, to trade on the past without offering anything new. To a certain extent, it's a no-win situation. If you don't make the same kind of music that first brought you acclaim, your old audience feels betrayed. If you labor steadfastly to reproduce your old sound, you'll just get jumped. The critics will say you're a dusty fossil, and the diehard fans will say, why should I buy your new product when I can get your great old stuff on CD? This is the story of two comeback attempts. Little Feat, a highly acclaimed Los Angeles cult band, has made a solid new album that has already failed in the marketplace. The other is by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, who've made a pretty dreadful new album that shows every sign of turning into a hit. There's no justice in the world. American Dream is only the third studio album that David Crosby, Stephen Stills, Graham Nash, and Neil Young have recorded together, and an enormous amount of goodwill still exists for the group's first and most famous effort, 1970's Deja Vu. In 1988, none of their careers is in particularly good shape, and there's an air of desperation about American Dream. Those familiar, reedy harmonies sound rather forced, and the title song, which reaches for a grand pronouncement about the state of our nation, is almost breathtakingly cynical. David Crosby recently released a brave, interesting autobiography called Long Time Gone, in which he admitted with a curious mixture of shame and pride that he recorded every second of his most famous music under the influence of one drug or another. But good intentions have not yielded good art. Now a testifying teetotaler, Crosby has written some of the worst music of his career for American Dream. His voice is in very good shape, though. It's just that he's using it to sing hippie banalities like this, Nighttime for the Generals.
Nighttime for the generals, the boys at the CIA. Power gone mad in the darkness, thinking they're God on a good day. They give up, they take it, they like to take it away.
In attempting their comeback, Little Feat was in a considerably more awkward position than Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young were. After all, even when David Crosby was stoned, at least he was still alive. By contrast, Lowell George, the guiding intelligence behind Little Feat, died in 1979. Up till then, Little Feat had earned a solid cult following and a lot of respect from their peers for their novel mixture of rock, soul, blues, and whatever pop style happened to catch Lowell George's fancy. This new Little Feat album, Let It Roll, replaces Lowell George's growly lead vocals with the softer, more mannerly ones of Craig Fuller, who used to be in Pure Prairie League. But other than that, Little Feat is pretty much intact. On a new song like Hate to Lose Your Lovin', it sounds to me like Little Feat has managed to recapture their old sound with fresh energy. Throughout most of this album, Little Feat manages a tricky balance. They've rooted a lot of their new music in their old, familiar style. They're not disowning their past. But at the same time, they're moving on, staking out new territory. For example, the old Little Feat, prone to cheerful discursiveness, would never have recorded as tight and precise a pop song as this one, One Clear Moment. Little Feat's comeback had the odds stacked against it. Where Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young were superstars, Little Feat had a comparatively small following to rouse up again. But the best music on Let It Roll is as good as rock and roll reunions get.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. That's Little Feat on Fresh Air. Twenty-five-year-old Trey Ellis describes his first novel, Platitudes, as an anti-first novel. He says it's more of a parody of a coming-of-age story than the real thing. In Platitudes, you won't find the author thinly veiled as a painter or photographer struggling to figure out his future. Platitudes is also a parody of experimental fiction. It's a comic novel about the clash between two black writers with different literary styles. Reviewing the novel for the Village Voice, critic Marcellus Blunt wrote, "If Alice Walker and Ishmael Reed got together to write a novel, it might read a bit like Platitudes."
Basically, it's a love story narrated by two different middle-aged writers, this failing and misogynistic male experimental writer, who I guess is sort of what I'm afraid I would have become if I hadn't sold this book and were still proofreading. And a very successful, not-to-be-named female writer, both black. And I guess the main difference is not only political, but it's stylistic, where she is what I call Afro-Baroque, very classically black in the sense that she talks about poverty and the South and bare feet. And he is very consciously modern, where he talks, his subjects are urban, and he's got a lot of lists and references to other works of fiction.
I'd like to have you read a passage from each of the two novels, the novel written by the male experimental writer and the female writer who you describe as Afro-Baroque in style. Why don't we start with the male writer and read, if you would read the opening of the novel he's writing.
Okay. Chapter 1. The digital alarm clock rolls little 7, 0, and 0 cards, white on black, over the 6, the 5, and the 9. Wah, off. Waffle-colored fingers have crawled from under both the regular and the fitted sheets, which have been detached from the bed, twisting around his waist between his legs. Earl's finger has pressed the white clock button in to free it to poke farther out. Light pours through the apartment window over the large chiffleur leaves. It filters past the P-38 Mustang and the four-stage SD Saturn V rocket, one nose-diving, the other rising, but both from monofilament fishing line lashed to the curtain rod, and both stream red-dyed cotton ball flames. Quivering shadows dapple the room's far wall and Earl's collection of college pennants, and the large map of the world voodooed with red-headed pins through the heart of every city Earl will visit on his sabbatical from Caltech or MIT or someplace like that. He peels his face off the plastic mattress cover, a bumper sticker separating from its backing. Earl, croons a too sweet voice from outside his door. It's time to wake up. Okay.
Would you read us the opening that the feminist novelist... Is it fair to call her a feminist novelist?
Yeah, radical feminist novelist.
Okay. Would you read us the opening that she writes when she's offering her interpretation of how this novel should have been written?
Okay. Chapter 1. Rejoice. Earl awakened to a day as new and as fresh as Mama's hand-starched and sun-dried petticoat. A huge plain garment as large and as fresh-smelling as the revival tents that bloomed every summer along Route 49 in Lowndes County, Georgia. Yes, from out of those wide Baptist thighs that shook with the centuries of injustice and degradation, thighs that twitched with the hope of generations yet unplanted, thighs that quivered with the friction of jubilant bed-thumping and funky-smelling lovemaking, emerged Earl.
Did you feel caught between these two styles when you started writing yourself?
Yeah, I did. I'm not as sexist as Dwayne, and I'm not as, let's say, Afro-Baroque as Ishii. I grew up, of course, reading a lot more of a lot more books written in Ishii style, and I loved them. Just now, I think we're getting to a point of diminishing returns. There's so many, too many authors, I think, who think this is the only way to write a book. Too many black authors. And there are a lot more different traditions that we can call upon.
Well, you're coming out of the tradition of being of a prosperous family living in New York. Did you get to a point where you felt that the Southern-based stories about people growing up in poverty just really wasn't exactly your story?
It's strange because I didn't grow up in I live now in the Upper West Side in a fancy apartment, that was my parents, but I grew up in a working class Italian and Irish neighborhood in outside of New Haven, Connecticut, which is still very different from the rural South. So I did feel a little divorced from that, and I shouldn't have to feel guilty about being a third generation Northerner.
One of the things that makes your novel fit into the experimental form is that you have all kinds of things collaged in, SAT exams, lyrics of songs, fragments of memories. I think I'm going to ask you to read some of that. Would you maybe read some of the SAT tests that you have included in there and explain what it's doing in there?
Sure. I wanted to put in what I call these pyrotechnics, any different type of writing I could think of, because it's a book about writing, but it's trying to be a funny book about writing and not a difficult-to-read experimental novel. So I just thought of everything written, from menus to lists to tests to questionnaires to screenplays, and one of them is this PSAT that the kids in the book are taking, and it's an experimental PSAT, so the questions are a little unusual. And here goes. Preliminary Scholastic Aptitude Test. Test booklet number DE101BR-H. Section 1, Verbal Relationships. Choose the words whose relationship most closely resembles the first cluster group conglomerate. Example, miscegenation is to crime as A, black is to beige, B, zebra to ape, C, Jane Russell to a sexy woman, D, jelly roll to gate mouth.
And the answer
the correct answer is C, because just as miscegenation used to be a crime, Jane Russell used to be a sexy woman.
I like that. Did you have fun coming up with these? I mean, these are not from real exams. We know that.
Yeah, I mean, I love doing this stuff. I was the editor of my college humor magazine at Stanford, and I just have always wanted to be, a stand-up comedian. So I tried to put in as many jokes as I could.
You had mentioned that you grew up in mostly white neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if that ever made you feel uncomfortable, if growing up in a more white-oriented world made you feel like you had to prove your blackness more in any way.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it definitely screws you up and makes you a stranger in both worlds. In my elementary school, my sister and I were the only blacks not bused into school, so daily we'd be called nigger on one side and Oreo on the other.
Go ahead.
I think that's probably where my sense of humor comes from, just because I survived growing up like that.
Well, so many writers talk about growing up as outsiders and therefore just observing everything around them.
That's definitely true. I think that's also why the book is so filled with different people's styles and why I think I'm an okay mimic of different people's styles.
What kind of response have you gotten to your novel from both from writers and from readers?
So, well, the people that come up to me and say anything have all said they liked it, but, you know, they could just be being nice. You know, I haven't gotten any nasty letters from people. I've gotten some, you know, letters from strangers, which is strange. I didn't expect that. Saying that they, other kids like me, let's say young black kids who grew up in white neighborhoods or who grew up mainly around white people, but are still politically and diehard black, if that can be, have called me or written me and said they didn't think that anyone else had grown up like them. So that's been nice.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was great.
Trey Ellis's first novel, Platitudes, is published by Vintage. This is Fresh Air. Alex Chadwick is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Terry.
How are you covering the earthquake in the Soviet Union?
We are going to speak to a reporter in Moscow, an American reporter, who has just watched the evening newscast there in the Soviet Union. Apparently, they just devoted unprecedented coverage to a natural disaster there. The earthquake, you know, happened in the region of Armenia, northern Armenia. There are estimates of deaths ranging from tens of thousands to perhaps as much as 100,000. We'll also speak to Cojautec Cardenas, who is the opposition leader in Mexico. We'll have more on Mr. Gorbachev's arms reduction proposals and other stories coming up in a little while here on All Things Considered.
From National Public Radio. Film critic Stephen Schiff says his favorite movie of the holiday season isn't from Hollywood. It's the Spanish farce Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, directed by Pedro Almodovar. The movie opened the New York Film Festival earlier this year, has been playing in New York since Thanksgiving, and is opening around the rest of the country at Christmas. Stephen says seeing this movie should be a must on your list of holiday things to do.
Is it still too early to announce the arrival of the best movie of the year? Perhaps. But Pedro Almodovar's Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown is the most seductive, original, and altogether invigorating film I've seen since Blue Velvet, and it's the meatiest comedy to emerge from Europe since the death of Luis Buñuel. It's a breakthrough picture, and not just for Almodovar. This movie's polish and breadth proclaim the coming of age of Spanish pop culture in the post-Franco era. Almodovar has been a famously exuberant Madrid scene maker since the late 60s. But it wasn't until 1980 that he began writing and directing the hilariously subversive black comedies that brought him international attention. American audiences received their first jolting dose in 1985 with the release of his ramshackle but rudely funny What Have I Done to Deserve This? That was followed by the swirl and fervor of Law of Desire in 1987, and this year's unsettlingly dark sex comedy Matador, which makes bitter fun of all things Spanish, including bulls. But nothing Almodovar has done before can prepare you for the wildly stylized brilliance of Women on the Verge. The movie's a farce, but it's farce transfigured by tenderness. It plays like a cross between John Waters and Rainer Werner Fassbinder, yet underneath its bubbly camp runs a current of raw and painful emotion. Almodovar's great star, Carmen Mora, plays Pepa, a film dubber whose longtime lover jilts her, whereupon all hell breaks loose. By the time the movie comes to its extravagant close, the story has dipped into every goofball plot device from incest to terrorism, and its decor into every eye-popping tint from chewing gum pink to midnight purple. Women on the Verge is as artificial and frothy as a 50s fashion layout, but it's also weirdly touching. Taking cues from directors as diverse as Hitchcock and Antonioni, Almodovar creates comic images that are inexplicably arresting, even haunting. A madwoman on a motorcycle, her hair streaming behind her, or another woman, genuinely on the verge of a nervous breakdown, lighting fire to her bed and soberly watching it burn. That's an emblem of love, of her past, and of men and what they do to the hearts of women. Deep down, this movie is an impassioned study of romantic betrayal, impassioned not just because of Almodovar's flamboyant direction, but because of his profound sympathy for women in love. He creates women who are stereotypical on the surface, and then he burrows inside them until he finds their uniqueness. He's some sort of underground humanist. In Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, Pedro Almodovar has managed to make sentiment look hip.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, writer Paul Gruchow talks about the American landscape. His new collection of essays, The Necessity of Empty Places, explores what he calls the invisible but increasingly tenuous link between our humanity and the natural environment. Also, rock historian Ed Ward pays tribute to Roy Orbison, one of the great rock singers who died of a heart attack earlier this week. And critic at large Laurie Stone reviews a new work by performer Michael Motion that combines dance, art, and the music of percussionist David Van Tiegum. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.